yourselves.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In
exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Live. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Trump is the man who can save the Western world, and probably the human beings as well.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Live.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
Almost lost my wife, my 67 Corvette, and my cat.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to a Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. I've got a question for you, and I think it has a common sense answer to it. And as usual, with common sense and government, whatever answer you thought was common sense is not what the government plans to do. But when a state allows a convicted sex offender out of custody after that sex offender, usually a man, sometimes a woman, and these days, sometimes a pronoun. But when the state lets that convicted sex offender out of custody because the person has completed their sentence behind bars, should the system, the Department of Corrections, at least notify the public? Now, this has to do specifically with a policy being considered in Washington State, where they would let convicted sex offenders, after they've finished their term behind bars, out into the public, back into the community, and they would not notify the victims. They would not notify the community. They would not say, ready or not, here he comes. Yes, he's a convicted sexual criminal, but he's finished his time behind bars. We're going to send him out to the community. And no, we're not going to give you a heads up and tell you what's coming at you. Now, does that make any sense? Of course not. Anybody with any sense would say, when they allow this person out, they will immediately notify the public. That would be the common sense answer. I'm going to tell you the background behind this, because now it's a group. It's a part of a government organization with a long name. The Washington State Sex Offender Policy Board is considering a policy, and boy, are they trying to backpedal fast right now, because they realize how most of the people in the community, in this case, Washington State, although I could just as easily imagine the state of Oregon, perhaps the state of Idaho doing the very same thing, that when that happens, that the community is going to say, you needed to give us some heads up that this freak was coming back out of custody. And when I say freak, I understand. I've heard from people who've called this show who say, I was a sex offender. I went behind bars. I was convicted of my crimes. I paid my debt to society, and I've straightened out my behavior, and I've no longer offended or broken the law. To them, I say, good for you. Now, is that usually the case? I would say, no, it's not. Because having talked to the people who treat sex offenders any number of times, I've asked them, is there any way you can actually cure somebody who suffers from pedophilia? That is, somebody who is sexually attracted to children. And the answer is no. But is society trying to norm it? They absolutely are. There are people within the treatment community or industry, if you will, that make a lot of money doing it. There are people within the corrections divisions who allegedly work to benefit the public who want to call these people minor attracted persons. They want to call them MAPs, as though, yeah, you have an attraction to little boys or little girls. That's okay. It's just one of your peculiarities. No, it's not. It is criminal behavior. It is pathological behavior. It is dangerous behavior. And the public ought to know. But let me give you the details in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We like to call it the best conversation in talk journalism because we do it every day. We provide honestly provocative talk radio for now more than 23 years to the Pacific Northwest. At the end of this year, it'll be 24, and we'll be glad for that anniversary. So, if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, and I may get some naysayers on this and some of the other subjects we're going to talk about today, naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. Now, I got an email this morning from a gentleman who said, Lars, yesterday you suggested that Donald Trump should be the Speaker of the House. And I said, no, I didn't suggest it. I don't think that's a smart move for Trump, nor do I think that there's a majority of votes in the House of Representatives now that Kevin McCarthy has properly gotten the boot. He got a pink slip yesterday, and he was removed as Speaker of the House for the first time in American history. It was an historic event, although it should happen from time to time. I mean, it's actually a good thing that you know, no matter who you work for, whether you work for the public, allegedly, as a member of Congress, or you work at a regular job, you understand that if you don't do your job the way you promised to do your job, then you're likely to get a pink slip. Knowing that actually corrects a lot of behavior. But a gentleman had called the show, and a couple of people had emailed and said, hey, how about Donald Trump for House Speaker? And I explained to them, it is legal for a non-member of Congress to become the Speaker of the House. It's never actually happened in U.S. history. I don't even think it's likely to happen, but it could happen. They could put Donald Trump in as the Speaker of the House. And would it be entertaining? Absolutely. Would Trump try to get something done? Absolutely. And would the Democrats say, we're not even going to play ball. We hate this idea. We hate Donald Trump with a passion. They wouldn't have anything to do with him. If you think the Democrats treat the Republicans like they're toxic, even when the Republicans are the majority in the House of Representatives, can you imagine how Democrats like Nancy Pelosi and others would treat Donald Trump if he were Speaker of the House and if he was setting the agenda for that entire body? But the subject came back up. I didn't say it was a good idea. In fact, I think it would get in the way of Donald Trump running for office for president because he's going to be the next president of the United States. That will be decided by Americans just over a year from now in November of next year. But he was headed into the courtroom today in Manhattan. He's in this civil fraud trial on which they've already dismissed about 80% of the charges because the Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James, who is as political as the day is long, she forgot to check the dates, the expiration dates, you know, the statute of limitations dates. She forgot to check, and 80% of the charges she brought against Donald Trump could not be brought because they're beyond the statute of limitations. But here's the quote. The audio was too bad. It was lousy quality. But Trump said, a lot of people have been calling me about the speaker's job. All I can say is we'll do whatever is best for the country and for the Republican Party. I would love the idea of Donald Trump being Speaker of the House. If I didn't think that it would actually get in the way of him running for president, he's going to make a great president come January of 2025. But let me get back to what this crazy panel, the Washington State Sex Offender Policy Board, is doing. They put information in one of their recent agenda packets, and what it says is that they summarize a portion of what they call the Model Penal Code, and what they say is that under that proposal, they want to be able to release sex offenders, return them to your community, and then not tell the community that they're coming and not even notify their past victims that they're coming back to the community. I think that's dead wrong, and I'd love to hear somebody tell me otherwise. I may get some naysayer calls on that today, and I would welcome that discussion because every treatment person I've ever talked to said if somebody is convicted of committing sexual crimes against children, that is the kind of pathology which at best can be controlled, but it can never be cured. In any case, if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, Joe Biden knows how to buy votes, and now he's trying to use hundreds of billions of dollars of your money to do exactly that. We'll talk about it next. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
So awfully tragic, put on a happy face.
Yes, he has a face for radio. All the same, check out the Lars Rumble Daily at Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Joe Biden knows how to buy votes, and he tries to use our money to do it. That's why he keeps working to erase the student loan debts of tens of millions of people who don't want to pay their own debts that they incurred. They signed on the dotted line. They were adults when they said yes to it. They need to pay the bill. The president has tried various ways to dump that deadbeat debt on the majority of Americans who've never even sat in a college classroom. He got shot down by the Supreme Court not long ago, just months ago. The Supreme Court said you can't do that legally, Joe. So he's figured out other ways to do it. In the Northwest, the problem is terrible because former students have, on average, more loans than the average student nationwide. Half a million Oregonians owe a total of more than $20 billion back to effectively the taxpayers. And if that loan is erased or forgiven, those are fancy words for we're going to take these debts owed by these people and hand them to somebody else. And in most cases, those are people who've never even gone to college. In Washington State, 800,000 former students owe almost $30 billion. And 70% of those debtors are between 25 and 49. So they have plenty of time to pay their own bills if they're so inclined. It must make some of them feel kind of foolish, quoting Goodwill Hunting, to find out you wasted $150,000 on an education you could have got for $1.50 in late fees at the public library. But morally and ethically, how do you ever justify saying, I got this ridiculous degree in a major that ends in the word studies and found out it only qualifies me to pour coffee or flip hamburgers, so somebody else should have to pay my tab? How can you say that? And now Joe wants to buy your vote with debts that your grandkids are going to have to pay? Our question of the day comes in from Carrie. Lars, I work at St. Charles Medical Center in Bend. They put out a statement yesterday that in accordance with guidance from the Oregon Health Authority, caregivers are required to wear a mask in direct patient care areas. Not in the hallways, not in the cafeterias, just in the rooms. I can't find any recommendation from the Oregon Health Authority with such guidance. Do you know of any hospitals in the Pacific Northwest requiring this? I told Carrie that I'd check and try to find out. OHA typically will not talk to me, will not answer questions, and you can only find confusing information on their website. But if anybody knows the actual answer, whether or not OHA has given out authority or guidance or a rule that talks about mask wearing, I'd love to know about it. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
Well, Joe Biden is one of the multiple times winners of our Daily Grill, but I'm going to give the grill today to Joe Biden, who was, I'll remind you, overruled by the U.S. Supreme Court for trying to erase, meaning hand the debt to somebody else, $400 billion in student loan debt. And since then has found a way to otherwise erase or hand off the debt to for about a third of that amount, despite the fact that the Supreme Court called him out for trying to do it illegally. Today's best email so far, but you can always send more. This one comes from Charles. Lars, this mask nonsense that one of your guests, Dr. Henry Miller, continues to believe is settled science, it seems like masks would work, but they simply don't, and it's been known for many years. Even back in the 50s, it was known that masks were ineffective against tuberculosis and that they are far larger than a coronavirus by a factor of thousands. Prior to the COVID outbreak, I read The Great Influenza by John Barry, which, of course, is about the influenza pandemic of 1918 and 1920. It was written in 2004. During that pandemic, they quickly realized that lockdowns and masks were ineffective, even though it wasn't until after the pandemic ended that they determined the influenza was caused by a virus. That wasn't proven until the 30s, and bacteria were considered likely during the first months of the pandemic. The reason so many people, including doctors, believe that masks are effective is it seems so plausible that they would be. Fact of the matter is, is medical doctors are also humans, and humans don't truly have the ability to even accurately imagine so many things. For instance, people can't imagine how large the universe may be. In like fashion, humans can't also truly imagine how small a virus is. I think that explains much of the nonsense surrounding mask efficacy. Signed, your friend Charles. Charles, thanks very much for that. Let me grab one call before the bottom of the hour. Jenny's on the line at Camas. Hey, Jenny, you heard me talking about sex offenders, the ones who've served out their term behind bars for the time that they were sentenced to, and they're now going to be released. And now the consideration by the Washington State Sex Offender Policy Board to say, maybe we can let these people go without telling the public that we're letting them out of custody. What do you make of that?
Hi, Lars. You and I hardly ever agree on a policy, but I think I have one you might like.
Okay. Let's go for it.
There's a panel of people who are deciding that it's okay to let John the sex offender, and I'm sorry, they are sex offenders and pedophiles, out because he stayed in jail a while. Okay. Well, if you're insisting on that and you're going to make it happen, I know where they have to live. Every single one of them that gets let out has to live next door to that person on the panel's child or grandchild.
I love that idea. I mean, it would actually bring some accountability. Jenny, it's one of my favorite tests. Go ahead, ma'am.
They just don't seem to get it. And, you know, I guess the truth of it is it's for them, it's a fine policy. I used to live in California, and in a very, very, very low-rent area, there was a quote-unquote halfway house for pedophiles. It was in the most high-crime neighborhood you can imagine. And what if we had to put that next door to the panel people?
I think they'd wake up. Jenny, my favorite test, I've had people call the show before and say, well, you know, maybe these people have changed, as though they're like burglars or armed robbers. Well, sometimes criminals change. But pathology, when it has to do with the way your brain is wired, most adults can't even imagine why anybody would be sexually attracted to a child. That's happening inside the brain of a pedophile. But my favorite test for them, I've had a few of them say, well, look, Lars, they've served their, you know, they've paid their debt to society. They served the 5 years or the 10 years or whatever it was behind bars. So they paid their debt, and we should forgive them of that. And they should be able to go back out in the community like anybody else. And I usually will ask that person, so do you have a child or grandchild? And if they say yes, I say, is that grandchild ever in daycare or gymnastics classes or whatever? And they'll say, well, yeah. And I said, well, not even that. But I said, would you put your child or grandchild in the care of a convicted pedophile, but one who has served his term behind bars? And they say, of course not. And I say, well, you see, why should you be able to make that decision and continue to condemn this person? If you say we should treat them like anybody else, we should put the people you care about most in the care of that pedophile. And you immediately reject the idea. The minute, as you suggested, that you make it personal for somebody and you say, okay, they're going to live next to you or maybe next to your son or daughter or grandson or granddaughter, that they immediately reject the idea. Apparently these boards say, yeah, we're going to let the sex offenders go as long as they don't live next to me. Welcome to Wednesday on the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
Get going because I keep you here too long because you know all what I'm about to I've said and you know what I've done and you know what we're doing and you know what I know what you're doing. Let me close with this.
He's a president now, baby. He don't even know his name.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's my pleasure to be with you. And I want to talk a little bit about the fact that the folks in government do not seem to be able to spend our money well. And when it comes to investing money, they're even worse. Would you believe that one of the biggest debts that Oregonians owe, because you think, well, no, Lars, Oregon and Washington and Idaho, they all run with constitutions that require that they run a balanced budget. Except that what they do is they sneak around it by saying to public employees, we're going to give you this whopping big pension when you retire. and then the state of Oregon does not set aside the amount of money necessary to pay those pensions when they come due. Now, is the PERS system broke today? No. Is it still writing checks to retirees today? Yes. Do they have the money to continue writing those checks into the future? And the answer is no, they don't. And what's happened in the last 1 year, the funding deficit in Oregon's public pension system grew by $8 billion just last year. $750 million every month. They lost money when they invested in all these, you know, different investments that PERS parks the money in until it's actually due to be paid out. They had the worst investment performance that they had seen in more than a decade. I mean, they're really bad at investing money. Now, I will tell you something else. The official number that PERS gives out as to how much of an unfunded liability, meaning money they owe or will owe eventually that they do not have cash to cover, is $28 billion, $8 billion higher than it was just a year before. And in fact, when you take a look at some of the performance of how their investments do, you'd almost be better just parking that money in the Dow Jones, you know, or the S&P, or one of those. It would produce a better return. But they, and that's understating it to some extent. PERS officially says we're $28 billion underwater. We're $28 billion in the red. Now, California is even worse. California owes about $250 billion that they do not have. They will need it eventually. And if it's not made up by investments of the PERS board, guess who's on the hook to pay it? That's going to be taxpayers like you and me. We're going to have to pay the tab. You don't get away with saying, let's go bankrupt, because you might remember a few years ago when the city of Detroit, Michigan, went bankrupt officially. And they said, well, of course, we're not going to pay those pensions. If the city is bankrupt, you have to reserve all the government's money to be able to provide the services that people of that city expect. No. The unions went to court, and the court said you will pay the pensions even if you don't have the money to pay for all those other services. So if you think, well, I'm not a public employee, so this isn't going to come home to me, it is going to come home to you. So the PERS board, already $20 billion underwater at the beginning of last year, was $28 billion in the red by the end of last year. And I think that understates it, because PERS has for years said our average rate of return is like 7.3%, except their actual rate of return is about a half a point lower. You say it's a half percentage point. How much difference could that make? Over the course of decades, it makes literally billions of dollars of difference. And any of you who follow how your pension or your 401k is performing, half a point of difference is all the difference in the world. So you are being sunk into more and more red ink. And the sensible way to pay it is to start having the state of Oregon have to real-time fund all of its pensions, meaning not put all the money aside. But what's required in the private sector is, if you want to promise a pension of, say, $10,000 a year or $100,000 a year to your retirees, you have to put away enough money that will earn enough money over the next several decades to be able to pay that money. If a private company fails to do that, the law, ERISA, actually says the government can send the people managing the fund to prison for not doing it. In the state, not nearly so much. Now, let me jump to a naysayer first. 866-439-5277. John, what do you and I disagree about today that would make you a naysayer?
Okay, I am a fan of yours, by the way. So let's move on.
Thank you.
There's usually a but at the end of that, but go ahead. No, there's no caveat here. I am actually a fan. Anyway, your assertion is that the government, most local municipalities, all the way up to the federal government, are unintelligent, okay? What I would like to suggest is this, that they're not unintelligent. They're smart as hell, and they're grifters, and they're criminals. Well, the ones that are unintelligent and the gullible are the liberal Democrat voters, the pawns that put these grifters into places of power. There's your problem, okay? These are criminals that are making up money for them. Not only them, they're enriching themselves as well as their other criminal friends, okay? They're doing exactly what they want to do. They're criminals, okay?
Well, that's what's going on. I don't necessarily reject the premise. I also think they're greedy, and I think they're lazy, and I could back that up. But tell me, I don't know if you're talking about the PERS problem or something else when you say they're making money, because I don't see how you make money when you put the government $8 billion more in the red in a single year. But maybe you're thinking of something else.
Follow the money, Lars. Follow the money, okay? Wherever they're investing the money, someone on their team is making money, okay?
Well, you are right, that, but here's where it just gets down to, it's hard to believe that it's not just stupidity, because when the state of Oregon or the state of Washington says, we're going to take that PERS money, we know we have to earn a return on it, we're going to park it here, and then investment officers do get paid commissions based on the kind of return that they generate. If they generate a bigger return, just like in the private sector, they get paid more. If they generate a smaller return, they get paid less. So,
right, where are they parking the money is the question. See, wherever they're parking that money, someone's making grifting money off of everyone else, right?
Maybe. But I mean, if let's say the investment officers say, we're going to park, nobody ever parks all their money in one place, but if
right.
you parked all your money in Apple stock or Microsoft stock or Nike
right.
stock, and the Nike stock goes down, or doesn't perform as much as the investment officer said it was going to, how do you
right.
make money when you lose money or don't perform? You know, in other words, if you're making 3%, you thought you were going to make 6, you're not losing money. You're just not gaining it very fast. And when inflation is going past that, you know, you're effectively losing money. How does that earn somebody any more money by losing money?
Oh, the morons that vote for these people aren't making any money. If they do, I would be
I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the investment people.
Right.
And they park the money in Apple stock, and then Apple stock doesn't perform as well, or Tesla or whatever. How does that return some kind of graft?
It doesn't, but why? The question is, why are they parking it here, there, and there? Why? That's the question you need to ask. Why are they specifically targeting these particular areas to dump that money into? This is how the mob works, Lars. You know this.
Well, but that's when you make... And the mob would park, if they park money in drugs or prostitution or money laundering or things, you can see how the mob would make money on illegal enterprises. But in all of these investments, they're standard stock investments. The fact is, you know that there are good investment firms that seem to return a very good return, and there are ones that don't perform as well. That seems to be the government-run investment officers who don't seem to be able to make the kind of money they promise they're going to make. And frankly, the investment officers who work for the state of Oregon, if they have a big return, they get paid a higher commission. If they have a low return, they get paid a lower commission. So
and
they're
I
not making
that.
Any
I,
money on the deal.
Yeah, and I get that. But that part of it probably is the laziness that you're talking about. And the stupidity.
They don't want to go
ignorant.
To the voters and taxpayers and say, by the way, if we want to fully fund the pensions the way they're required to in the private sector,
yes.
you either have to accept fewer teachers, fewer cops, fewer firefighters, or pay a
right.
lot more in taxes. One or the other, but you don't get both. John, thanks for the call. In a moment, the woman who peddled influence out of the Oregon governor's office is trying to reinvent herself and rewrite her own history online.
Fix stupid.
Stupid is forever.
But you surely can vote them out. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, which I'm very proud of. We started almost 24 years ago. And what is it? It's a network of 26 stations throughout the Northwest, and I can't thank all of them enough. We stretch through Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And as I said, we've not quite been around for about a quarter of a century, and we're glad to serve the Northwest. So what do we got on tap today? Our Twitter poll, would you support Republicans making Donald Trump Speaker of the House? I've already told you it's legally possible for a non-member of the House of Representatives, Donald Trump in this case, to be the Speaker of the House. Do I think it's politically likely? No. Do I think that it would benefit Trump running for office to tie him up with the day-to-day duties of being Speaker of the House? No. But he has said that he's open to the idea. He said this just this morning. A lot of people have been calling me about the speaker position. All I can say is we'll do whatever is best for the country and the Republican Party. So basically, Trump, and God bless him, has been dangling some red meat in front of the media, because most of the liberals would go absolutely out of their minds if he became Speaker of the House or if there was even a vote on that question. But would you support Republicans making Donald Trump Speaker of the House? I'd say yes. I've already told you I don't think it's likely to happen, but would I support them? Sure. More than anything else, I would support them because it'll drive the Democrats and the liberals absolutely out of their minds. So you can vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Yesterday's Twitter poll was this: should government make it even harder to build homes in the Northwest by cutting off access to water? Now, this has to do specifically with state of Oregon, where the water managers have said, we're going to make it a lot tougher to drill wells. Now, I know that the majority of it, I don't get my water from a well. I wish I did. I wish I had control of my own water supply. Instead, I buy it from Clark County. But if you're going to tell people who live in rural parts of the state of Oregon, you have a piece of property, you'd like to build a house there, either for yourself or to sell or rent to somebody else, and now we're going to make it even harder for you to be able to get the water that is absolutely necessary for anybody who wants to build a home, I think that's crazy. So I said, no, the government should not make it harder. 92% of you agreed and said no as well. Only 8% of you said yes. And I just want to mention this, too. Tina Kotek ran for governor. She is now the governor of Oregon. She doesn't seem to have a clue as to how things actually work. But she said, we're only building about 18,000 homes, both apartments and single family homes and the like. Only about 18,000 a year. We're going to double that to 36,000. And like most other things that the government promises to do, Tina Kotek has not the first clue as to how to make that happen. What she can do, and what it sounds like she's going to do, is she's going to take hundreds of millions of your dollars, and she's going to use them to try to incentivize the private sector to double the amount of housing that it builds in Oregon. And here's the argument I'd give you, and that is, if the private sector could double the amount of housing it's building, it would do it right now. It can't, and mostly it can't, because of the government. And why do I say that people in the private sector who build housing would double the output of housing if it actually made economic sense? The answer is, everybody who builds housing makes more money if they build twice as much of it, except when the government comes in and says, we're going to have urban growth boundaries. That's going to make land hard to find and hard to get permission to build on. We're going to put on the average family, single family home in Portland, for example, about $100,000 in government fees that must be paid before you stick a shovel in the dirt or pound a nail into a piece of 2x6. You pay $100,000 to the government. Now, I frequently hear from people saying, Lars, you only gripe about stuff all day long. How about some solutions? So I usually try to make a suggestion as a solution. You know what my solution would be? You want to double or triple the amount of housing built in the state? First of all, give an exemption. Everybody who comes into any city or county in Oregon or Washington, for that matter, and wants to build apartments, single family homes, duplexes, whatever it is they're building, you give them an 18-month window. If you come in and submit your paperwork to build that house, we're going to waive all of the fees, or we're going to waive half of the government fees, or we'll waive a third. You'd probably get a ton of action if you just waived a quarter of the fees. And if somebody who's in the home building business wants to call me up and say, Lars, you're wrong, we wouldn't do it for that. If they're paying $100,000 for every single family house, and you could cut that cost by $25,000 for a year and a half, as long as you start construction within the next 18 months, tell me that wouldn't work. I believe that it absolutely would work. And unfortunately, I don't think that's the way the government's going to do it. They're just going to grab more money. I'm going to have to make this one quick. Naysayer Lee, we're close to the break. What do we disagree about?
Lars, you just put your thumb on the problem with the Republican Party. In your Twitter poll, you like it because it would drive the Democrats crazy.
Yep.
When are the Republicans going to start thinking about what would be good for America and not what is going to hurt members of the Democrats?
They did yesterday when they voted out Kevin McCarthy, who had promised, I will not fund the government through a continuing resolution. And then he did exactly that last weekend. He broke his promise. He deserved to be fired. And that's a serious answer.
The Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Trump is the man who can save the Western world, and probably the human beings as well.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Live. And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
Almost lost my wife, my 67 Corvette, and my cat.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk. Now, yesterday, I told you the fact that Washington State now has seen a gigantic jump in the number of infants and small children who are overdosing from fentanyl. So we're not talking about adult drug addicts. We're not even talking about teenagers who say, well, we went out to party and we thought we bought some cocaine and then it turned out to be fentanyl instead, like the incident that happened on Monday morning when eight people, all young adults, overdosed at the same time in the same place, literally in downtown Portland in broad daylight. And you say, okay, that's terrible. It's tragic. But we're talking about kids too young to even be involved in that. And the question I keep wondering about is, how long are the voters and the citizens of Oregon and Washington going to watch kids die from fentanyl overdoses before they demand the changes that we've talked about on this show? I thought I'd put that question to Washington State Senator Linda Wilson, who joins me now. She represents the 17th legislative district, so she spends a lot of time in Olympia. Senator Wilson, welcome back.
Hey, thank you so much, Lars.
Is there an answer to that? I mean, how long? I mean, are we just going to accept that the new normal is, yeah, we'll have young adults, we'll have other people, and even toddlers, and they'll end up dead or barely recovered by being resuscitated from a fentanyl overdose. And this is just part of the new norm of living in the Northwest.
Right. Well, I don't think that we need to be paying attention to this. Absolutely. And last year, about this time, I was contacted by the Clark County deputy prosecutor that works directly with the Children's Justice Center. And so he deals with this stuff all the time. And he was telling me that the law had not been updated since 2005, which when it was methamphetamine and we had the labs and all that, and children were being exposed to meth, you know, the meth labs and overdosing. And so, but fentanyl is not included because it's synthetic opioid and it's not included in the law. So he said, we can't really do much with this. So as an example, right now, if a child overdoses and it's the parents that expose them to it, smoke or, you know, inhaling or taking the pills or whatever, they can only be charged with reckless endangerment. And that right now is only a gross misdemeanor and up to $5,000 for 1 year in jail and $5,000 fine. So he wants to increase our add fentanyl to the law so that we can do something, because if a child dies, clearly there's, unfortunately, there's something that we can do, charge the parent with the death. But there's not much we can do to hold them accountable for overdosing their own children. And that's what this would do. So I introduced a bill last year. I worked with him and I introduced a bill. It sailed through the Senate. It was unanimous going through the Senate. It got to the House and died. And so, quite frankly, this was my number one bill last year because it's so important and it's taking the same trajectory, the overdoses in children, as fentanyl is in the state and the country.
Let me ask you something, Senator. Most of us, I've never been a state lawmaker, but how is it possible for a bill that gets majority support or gets a unanimous vote in one chamber does not get a huge amount of attention, if not an almost immediate trip to the floor to be talked about and voted on. How is that possible? I mean, does one chamber say, oh, yeah, they passed about unanimously over there, but, yeah, we probably don't even want to look at that one here? I mean, how does that happen?
It depends upon who is the chair of the committee it's going through. And then in this case, it was Representative Goodman, who's the chair of public safety. And he heard the bill and then had an issue with exposure. He said he's had an issue with exposure for quite some time. And I said, well, but I'm not changing that. But we can change that if we have to.
Okay, explain what the issue is with exposure. Does he mean that if a parent takes a child to the public park and the child picks up some piece of drug litter that's on the public park grass and then dies, that you're not going to charge the parent unless you can show the connection that the parent is the one who exposed the child? I can understand that,
right.
But what was his objection?
Right. He just told me that his caucus wouldn't support this. And I was flabbergasted because of the fact that it failed through the Senate. But
meaning the Democrats won't support it, right?
Yes.
Well, so Democrats want children to die of fentanyl.
There's a faction in their caucus that don't want to hold people that have drug crimes or any of that to be held accountable. And that's the issue. The only thing is, well, what we're wanting to do here is we're wanting to make this a Class B felony with a seriousness level of 4, which would be if they knowingly or intentionally permit it or a dependent child or adult to be exposed to or ingest or inhale or have contact with that methamphetamine or the components used for methamphetamine.
Or fentanyl.
Exactly. Yeah. We want to add fentanyl and synthetic opioids so that this doesn't happen again. Because there's always new drugs, right? And that's where the statute fails, is that it didn't include any new drugs coming on board. And we know that it's getting stronger. And, I mean, I just read something yesterday that said that they're coming out with rainbow pills and pieces that look like chalk, like children use to write on a sidewalk. So it's getting easier and easier for these kids to see this stuff and think that it's either a toy or it's, you know, Skittles.
So hold on. So these are the same knuckleheads who'll tell you all day long they don't want flavored vapes because a teenager might start vaping because it's flavored like cherry or some other flavor. But they're not worried at all about the kid ODing and dying from fentanyl. That just seems like, you know, your Democrat colleagues are just about as dumb as a bag of hammers.
Well, and what I believe that they're thinking is that they're concerned that if the parents are in jail, what will happen with the kids? It's ironically,
they'll go to a better home than being with a bunch of meth heads or people taking fentanyl. How about that?
Absolutely.
How about that as the bare minimum?
That's exactly right. And I can't figure out where they're going with that. So I'm really appreciating that we're talking about this because I want to put the pressure on so that we can get this bill through. Because even King County prosecutors didn't know that I was running the bill last year, but they know that this has to be fixed because we have to hold the parent accountable or the adult in the home that exposed them to it accountable. And doing it as a felony will help us. There's more drug courts. There's more, you know, even if you go to prison, the DOC has treatment programs and counseling and a ways to address their addiction, which they don't have now. But if we put the kid back into the same home with, clearly they're not making good decisions, right? Putting their own children's health at risk or
lives
at risk.
No, they're not. And by the way, Senator, that report I talked about yesterday was one that said, you know, you go back 4 years, there are maybe 20 overdose deaths in toddlers and small, you know, babies. And now we've got more than that number in Washington State. And the majority of the kids who are overdosing, in some cases dying, in some cases being resuscitated, there are more cases happening in Washington State than there were nationwide just 4 years ago. Senator Wilson, I hope we get the word out. I appreciate you coming on the show. That's Senator Linda Wilson from the 17th District. Coming up in a moment, I got to tell you a terrible story that involves what used to be a safe city, not so safe anymore, even for people not in harm.
Shut
Senator John Kennedy gets it.
Mr. President, you just got to try harder not to suck.
Well said, Mr. Kennedy. We agree. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. The question I've got for you is, how much danger do average Americans face in what were once safe cities? Now, I'm going to give you some background on that, but I've been covering courts and cops for more than 40 years as a reporter. And one of the things that's usually true is that when you are the victim of a violent crime, a murder, a rape, an armed robbery, an assault, in many, many cases, you know the person who attacked you. And murder, that's more often the case. There are a lot of robberies that are robberies by strangers of somebody they don't know. But it has usually been the case that you see an awful lot of murders that involve drug deals between people who know each other. They've associated with each other in some way. You see rapes that are committed by rapists who know their victim. And that's the case. These days, though, one of the most frightening aspects of the explosion of crime that has happened during Joe Biden's time in office, a little over 2.5 years, is that people who are just going about their business and they are doing nothing that puts them in harm's way. They're not showing up in a sketchy neighborhood at 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe to do a drug deal, and then getting assaulted or getting killed or getting shot. They're just going about their business on the regular course of things. They're not doing anything that would have put them in harm's way. And yet they're ending up either hurt or killed in so many cases. So crime is becoming something that usually in the past would have hit, in many cases, people become victims of crime when they are in those kind of dangerous situations. That's not blaming the victim, because all of our cities should be safe for all people in all neighborhoods. But what it's saying is that you can be just going about your business, doing things the right way, and you can still end up dead. Let me give you one specific example. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to take your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you happen to be a naysayer, why, we're going to put you right to the head of the line. We've done that for a long time. We always will. At 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. That's easy to remember. And if you want to vote in our Twitter poll, you can find it two different places, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, or X if you want to call it that. You can also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. But I thought about that connection between victims and the perpetrators when it comes to crime. And I also thought about the massive failure in criminal justice that we're seeing in America. And unlike a lot of other problems that involve a technical side that's hard to understand, you have to know physics or engineering, or you have to have a law degree to understand it, you can see how this kind of crime, this one crime I picked out of all the crimes we hear about all week long, every single week in America, this involves a guy who lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee. His name is Christopher Wright, 38 years old. He was going to his high school class's 20-year reunion when he was in Chattanooga. So he went to downtown Chattanooga on Thursday night, last Thursday night, to meet up with his fellow Baylor School alumni. And on the street, he got into an argument with a guy by the name of Daryl Roberts. Well, Daryl Roberts, his street name was Too Tall, according to the Chattanoogan, the local newspaper. And he ended up dead at the end of that exchange. Now, Wright, the victim in this case, father of three, including a brand new baby, 8 weeks old. And he ends up dead as a result. And then you ask, well, who is this Daryl Roberts, the guy they knew on the street as Too Tall? He was a bad guy. He was a guy with a, you know, as they describe, an arrest record or a criminal record as long as your arm. He had been arrested 66 previous times. And this guy is hanging around in downtown Chattanooga, but this could be almost any city in America, because we hear about this happening everywhere. You've got somebody who's a known criminal. They got a long, long record. They have a record of violent crime. We're not talking about somebody who burglarizes homes or burglarizes businesses. That's bad enough. But when you have somebody who has a violent history, and the system knows about him, and the system does not act to try to incapacitate him, Wright is talking to this guy, Wright is the man who was killed. He's talking to Daryl Roberts, and Roberts walked up to him, put his gun to Wright's head, and just pulled the trigger, shot him, killed him right there. They got him to the hospital quickly. He died anyway. And Roberts ran, Daryl Roberts, the criminal. He was captured by police the next day. They had the ATF looking for him. They had the U.S. Marshals looking for him. They had everybody looking for him. And then you take a look at this guy's rap sheet. He had assault. He had thefts. He had drug charges. He had burglaries. He had a whole series of traffic offenses. And remember, in most cases, when you're stopped on a traffic offense, you don't get arrested. You get a ticket. You go on about your way. You pay the bail. You resolve it. He had a case of aggravated robbery 20 years ago, in 2000, 23 years ago. And one of the most notable from that long list, according to the Chattanoogan, he conducted a home invasion robbery in 2010. So the system has known about this guy for the better part of the last two decades. In that home invasion, he shot six shots through a bedroom door at somebody's home. One adult, four children were behind the door. Fortunately, it sounds like Mr. Roberts was not a very good shot. He was then arrested 5 dozen times, but in all that time, 66 prior arrests, this guy never got more than 6 months that he actually served behind bars. Now, he's charged with first-degree murder, being held on $5 million bond. Now, thank goodness it's Tennessee, because in many of the biggest cities in America, like Los Angeles, like San Francisco, like Chicago and Philly and New York, all the activists on the liberal side of things would say, well, we can't hold this guy on all the other charges. On murder, yeah, they'll hold on to it, $5 million bond. But on all these other charges, the fact is that he just murdered this guy for no reason in particular. His family set up a GoFundMe page and all that. But this guy had a brand new baby who'd just come into the world about 8 weeks ago. And he gets shot to death in the downtown of an ordinary city like Chattanooga for no reason in particular. We have no other information about what his interaction with Roberts was before the guy just walks up to him, puts a gun to his head, and blows his brains out. I mean, this is the kind of thing. So it makes you wonder. I know that there are people who say, well, Lars, you can't walk around being scared all the time. But in Tennessee, you've got concealed carry laws. You know, what I expect to start hearing about is a whole bunch of criminals who end up threatening people in this way. And those people defend themselves and you get dead criminals instead of a dead law-abiding citizen who ends up dead because of a guy who should have been locked up a long time ago. The system knew he was a bad guy. They had warning after warning after warning, including a home invasion robbery more than a dozen years ago, and the system decided not to incapacitate him. And as a result, 38-year-old Christopher Wright is dead, his wife is a widow, and his babies have no father. In any case, it's beginning to happen in too many places, and we've got to demand that the system change the way it handles the known threats to society. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Network. The Lars Larson Show. Helping you know who to trust and reminding you of the principles this country was founded on.
The world's going crazy and they lie.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and emails. We'll get to those in just a bit. But as you saw, I didn't object at all to the removal of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House of Representatives. I thought that his major issue was continuing the government's funding through a continuing resolution, which is something he specifically said he would not do, instead of having an actual budget in place, which would give require Republicans to have a backbone, first of all. But one of the side issues was whether or not Americans actually still support the idea of shoveling out additional tens of billions of dollars for the war in Ukraine. That support is beginning to falter, although it seems to still be roughly majority for both Republicans and Democrats across the land. George Beebe joins me now, who's the former director of the CIA's Russia Analysis Department, former Russia advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney, and currently director of Grand Strategy at the Quincy Institute. Mr. Beebe, welcome back.
Thanks, Lars. Good to talk to you.
So does this change things with the House Speaker out? And now some question, I guess they're going to vote in about a week about choosing a new House Speaker. But what does this mean specifically for aid to Ukraine, which I'm not a fan of? And I've been honest with you about that before.
Well, I think this creates a lot of uncertainty about the future of American aid to Ukraine. This is a central issue in the dispute between Matt Gaetz and other dissident Republicans, if you want to call them that, and Kevin McCarthy. I think Gaetz believed that McCarthy had struck a secret deal with President Biden to continue funding to Ukraine, and Gaetz objected to that. And there is a lot of question right now about whether whoever becomes the new Speaker of the House is going to be willing to put aid to Ukraine up for a separate vote on the floor of the House. And if that doesn't happen, that creates an awful lot of uncertainty about what the future of aid to Ukraine will be. So this is a very consequential time.
Well, tell me this, Mr. Beebe, would you object to having a separate vote so that Americans can see how their representatives come down on either continuing to send large amounts of money or not? Because I think there's a plus to letting citizens see. It wasn't just Ukraine as packed in with the rest of a continuing resolution or even a budget. You actually got a separate, distinct vote on it. I think there's a plus to that.
Oh, I agree. I think absolutely there should be a separate vote on this. What the Biden administration has been doing now for quite some time is trying to embed money for Ukraine in broader, you know, omnibus packages of various kinds so that there isn't a direct vote up or down on aid to Ukraine. And I think there ought to be. This is an issue that is quite consequential for the security of the United States. And this is something that our representatives ought to be voting on.
Well, doesn't it suggest to you that when somebody says, I don't want to have a separate vote on it, I want to pack it in with a bunch of other stuff that Americans do want, that you're essentially admitting if it had to come to a separate vote on its own, it would get voted down?
Well, it might. I think that's still an open question. But at a minimum, it says that these representatives don't want to take responsibility, don't want to have accountability for their vote on this issue. And I think that is not in the spirit of democracy.
No, and in fact, when I looked at this most recent poll, and this one came, and it's a source I've not dealt with before, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, but they found 63% of Americans want continued aid to the war in Ukraine, and 53% say it's worth the cost, just over a majority. 45% say it's not been worth the cost, but they say that support appears to be beginning to dip. And I would suggest, and I don't know if you'd read it the same way, it sounds like an awful lot of Americans are starting to lose their taste for this particular conflict, especially given that the president won't explain what's the end game, when does this end, how long is this going to go on, and how much is it going to cost. And at this point, the administration doesn't seem to be willing to share that with the rest of us who pay the bill.
Well, I think that's right. The polls do point to a trend, and the trend is, in fact, toward growing skepticism about the war, more questions being asked about what the end game does, in fact, look like, in contrast to some sort of forever war, doing this for as long as it takes, as the Biden administration says, without defining what it really is. Now, the CNN poll that came out in August indicated that for the first time, a majority of Americans opposed continuing aid at present levels to Ukraine.
Yep.
So there is a little bit of disagreement in the polls, but all of them are showing a trend, which is toward growing skepticism about this war effort.
And yet Joe Biden has latched onto this. And I mean, among Democrats, this most recent poll says 77% of Democrats support continued funding to Ukraine. But I don't know if they're supporting it because they actually believe in it, or they're supporting it because they realize it's the policy of their president. And if they start to say, oh, no, we don't want this to happen, they're torpedoing Joe Biden's latest foreign policy adventure. And you remember the advisory from Bob Gates, who said, yeah, George Bush, Joe Biden has never made a correct foreign policy decision in his entire career. And this seems to be a continuation of that trend. And yet they've got a guy who's running for re-election, and his party wants at least a Democrat in office, although most of them seem to be not too crazy about having Joe Biden do a second term. And they're not too crazy about Kamala Harris either, but they want their side to win. And yet they're supporting an increasingly unpopular war. While the Republicans tend to be, the split in this latest poll suggests that 61% of Republicans say that U.S. weapons support has not been worth it, and only 38% say it's worth it. So the Republicans are saying this is not a good deal for Americans, and the Democrats are still supporting it, but they've got a presidential election to think about, and Congress as well.
Well, right. This, I think, is an argument for why Congress ought to be voting on aid to Ukraine separately, so that we can have a genuine debate about this war and what our plan really is for bringing it to an acceptable conclusion. And we've not really had that debate. I think this war has ruled out certain positions. Proponents of aid to Ukraine have argued that anyone that opposes it is un-American, unpatriotic, and in fact doing the bidding of Russia.
Yep.
And we've not allowed a debate to actually ask questions like, what is the plan for bringing this war to a successful conclusion? What is in America's national interest in order to make sure that the American people are protected, are secure, are living in a prosperous country, not getting involved in forever wars that don't have ends, don't serve the national interest? That is something that we need to be debating, and Congress is the place where that debate has to be focused.
Well, let's hope that starts happening. Mr. Beebe, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks, Lars.
That is George Beebe, the former director of the CIA's Russia Analysis Department and former Russia advisor to Vice President Dick Cheney. I'm glad to get your calls in the next segment at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Lighting a fire under those who need it.
So light 'em up, oh, 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 light 'em up, oh, oh, light 'em up, oh, oh, I'm a fire.
You know who you are. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Would you support Republicans making Donald Trump Speaker of the House? As I told you, it's politically unlikely, but it is legal and it could happen. They could make Donald Trump Speaker of the House in replacing Kevin McCarthy. You can find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go first to Paul in Woodinville. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, yeah, by the way, I would absolutely love it if Donald Trump were the Speaker of the House. That would be the best thing that ever happened to Democrats. But you make me laugh, Lars, when you say that Kevin McCarthy didn't have the guts to have a budget. Well, I hate to break it to you, friend, but we have not had a federal budget signed into law by a president, that one that outlines revenues and expenditures since George W. Bush in 2008.
Well aware of that, and I mention it frequently, Paul, and I have for years said we need to get back to regular budgeting, because if you just do things through CRs, continuing resolutions, go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've done. And everyone, so many Republicans say, we're not going to do CRs. But they're the ones who, they wouldn't give Obama a budget. And that's, remember, Obama said, if you're not going to give me a budget, give me 10% cuts across the board. Remember, that was the sequester.
And he got
sequester.
And John
Boehner said, I got 98% of what I wanted. Then they blame Obama for weakening the military with 10% cuts. Okay, Trump never submitted a budget. And he's, by the way, and the reason that they don't want it is because if you have a budget that outlines revenues and expenditures, you can't have tax cuts. And that's what Trump wanted more than anything, is whopping tax cuts for the rich. He blew $8 trillion. And by the way, Lars, $8 trillion, just to put it in perspective, is two-thirds of all the money that's ever
Hold
been
on.
Paid out.
I love the logic you use, Paul, when you say that when the government fails to take people's money away that they earn through taxes, that is blowing money by leaving it in the hands of the people who earned it. And by the way, Paul, I can beat the daylights out of your argument this was only for the rich. In percentage terms, the person making $50,000 a year in America got a bigger percentage cut in what they paid than the rich did. And I
that's
hope you're
wrong.
Aware of that, because
that's,
this
that's
old
wrong.
Line that this was all about just tax cuts for the rich, in absolute dollars, of course. But, Paul, I always illustrate these tax things by saying, if Paul and I both went down to the Nordstrom store in downtown Seattle, and we had each one of us had a 10% off coupon, and then Paul spends $10,000 at Nordstrom, and he saves $1,000. And I spend $50 at Nordstrom, and all I save is $5. Paul, as a liberal, would argue, you see, this benefited me more than it benefited Lars, because we both got 10% off, and Lars only saved $5, and I saved 20 times as much. I saved $1,000. That's because when you cut taxes, and even if the percentage cuts are bigger for average people making $50,000 to $70,000, as a total dollar amount, they're not going to save as many dollars. If the person up above, and I think the average cut for those in the top 1% was 12%. But 12% of Bill Gates or Paul Allen or Jeff Bezos is a whole hell of a lot more than even a 30% cut for the guy who's making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. And that's the game you're playing.
No, that's, can I respond?
Please. I'd love to hear.
First of all, the middle class tax cuts expired on December 31st, 2020, and the tax cuts for the rich and the corporations have continued. The middle class tax cuts, but here's what they did. Here was the problem, is many people got boosted into the 25% tax bracket, and then they got a cut on being boosted into a higher bracket, which basically made them the same. And here's the other thing, Lars, the way they adjusted the withholding tables so that people would look like they were, oh, I'm getting more money in my check. What happened was, you have to pay, the formula says that you have to pay either 100% withholding,
or no less than 90
last year, or 90% of what you're going to have to pay this year. People were under withheld, and they had to pay penalties on that under withholding, because even though it wasn't
if they were below 90, and that was a screw up by the government. But Paul,
that was a screw up by Trump.
Well, but when people say, gee, I didn't get the giant tax refund at the end of the year, as far as I'm concerned, Paul, anybody wants to loan Uncle Sugar a bunch of money with no interest paid at all and then get it back in 12 months? I don't think that's a very smart thing to do. Some people do like to do it. I'd rather have the amount withheld that I actually owe. Wouldn't you?
Trump tried to adjust that by saying if you were under withheld and you had to pay a penalty, he ordered the IRS to tell people that if you pay your taxes in 2019 by January 15th, you will not have to pay that penalty. Except, guess what? That was when Donald Trump shut the government down for a record 35 days and the IRS was closed, so nobody got the message.
Well, but except for this, Paul, I got to tell you something. You're going to tell me that the IRS is not weaponized against conservatives and in favor of liberals. You know they are. That deep state bureaucracy,
no, they're not.
They say, we don't give a damn what the president says. It's Donald Trump. We only follow orders from the president when he has a D in front of his name, like Joe Biden.
Yeah, so, little victim. Hey, you're a victim. You're a little
All I'm telling you is when people work within a bureaucracy and they say, we don't care who's at the head of the bureaucracy, whether the bureaucracy is Microsoft, Nike, or the IRS, and the IRS is always weaponized against conservatives, no, that doesn't fly. You got the Lars.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Trump is the man who can save the Western world, and probably the human beings as well.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
I may be a white boy, but I'm not stupid.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
Then we're going to kick the Biden crime family out of the White House.
Here's your host.
Almost lost my wife, my 67 Corvette, and my cat.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Wednesday, and it's the Radio Northwest Network, and we want to talk about how some of the small school districts in the Northwest have finally got tired of some of the school districts from the bigger population centers and said, hey, we deserve to have some equal representation. But before I do that, welcome to the program. If you want to jump in, it's the best conversation in talk journalism, and it's right here every day. 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. That's easy enough to remember. If you want to vote in the Twitter poll, today's question, would you support Republicans making Donald Trump Speaker of the House? It's legally possible. I don't think it's politically likely, and I don't think Donald Trump thinks so either, but it's certainly entertaining. They're now talking about Trump on the major legacy media saying, hey, he's one of the people running, along with Jim Jordan and Steve Scalise, who I think is the odds-on favorite to become the next Speaker of the House. But let's get back to education for a moment and the way your community is represented. And Lee Finna knows all about that. She's director of the Center for Education at Washington Policy. How are you doing, Lee?
Just great. How are you, Lars?
Not too bad, but would you mind help my audience understand how school districts, there are almost 300 of them in the state of Washington in this case, not Oregon. I don't know if they run things the same way there, but they apparently have a very bizarre way of representing the school districts in the state where the small towns get almost no say and the big population centers, you know, the kind of toxic big cities like Seattle or Tacoma or Spokane, hold most of the weight. Have I described it correctly?
You've described it perfectly correctly. What's happened here is there's an association of school board members who are elected to school boards in Washington State, and that association is called WASDA, Washington State School Directors Association. And for, since 1986, they have given the big populous districts, mostly in the Puget Sound area and on the western side of the state, a weighted vote when they decide what policies to push in their legislative assemblies in the next legislature, or whatever policies they think are important for all the districts across the state to adopt. And this is so since 1986, the vote has been in favor, you know, they've weighted the vote in favor of population of students in the district, not in a democratic way of one vote for every district. So last session, they all got together again on September 22nd, and they got rid of the weighted vote. Now every district has one vote. So now the small rural districts have quite a lot of power if they get together and vote a certain way. So it's a reflection of what's happening in politics, right? Everything is happening in these school districts now, and very exciting development towards having a more democratic voting process at this influential assembly of school board directors.
Lee, I think it's important for you to make it clear to my audience why this is. This isn't just a bunch of people who say we all sit on school boards and this is the club we belong to. They actually have a concrete effect on what your kids get taught and exposed to, or what they don't get taught and exposed to. Is that fair to say?
Yes, because they have lobbyists down in Olympia. And they go down and this assembly of school board members decides what to ask the legislature to pass in terms of laws and such, okay? And policies in the schools. And The problem with this association is that it's very close to the union. Basically, everything that the union wants, this association wants, because it's been captured by the union. So now we have, what's exciting is now we have sort of a grassroots rebellion against this top-down control by the union in their association. So the first thing they did was to get vote down a radical proposal from the Edmonds School District to put diversity and global citizenry and inclusion, all the CRT stuff in all the districts across the state. And that's what the fight's about. Of course, the state's trying to do it through legislation, and the union is now trying to do it through this WASDA assembly, and they have lost their power in that assembly. So that, because now, what they did, these small districts got together and they defeated a proposal that was going to ramp up the critical race theory, harmful stuff, you know, the radical gender stuff in the schools.
Well, and let me ask you, would this also have an effect on things like the child kidnapping bill? Because schools are very involved in that if a child says, I'm transgender, my parents aren't crazy about it, and then that child can be told, well, go run away to a shelter. The shelter won't tell your parents where you are because you're seeking to go from boy to girl or girl to boy, and we'll help you make it happen. A lot of teacher and school involvement in that. Did WASDA take a position, say, on that child kidnap bill? Because it ended up passing.
Yes, that's a great question. I don't know how they testified on that bill. I guess they did.
Would you guess that with a Puget Sound influence that they probably said, yeah, we want teachers to be able to advise kids, you can change your gender, we'll keep it secret from your parents, we'll hide you from your parents, and we'll even help finance the changeover for the chemical castration and other changes that they would do.
It's terrible. It's terrible what's happening. And WASDA is part and parcel of what's been done to kids in Washington State, for sure. So now, though, the voting power has changed, and maybe there will be a proposal from the school board members, from the more rational school board members, to get rid of this secrecy, this secret policy of holding this information away from parents. I mean, the idea that the schools are being told to lie to parents when a child wants to change sex after being encouraged by the schools to change sex is just outrageous. And no wonder people are running for school board and changing these voting rules. This is what this comes from.
I got to tell you something, Leave. I never knew this was the policy, that literally you could have a couple of schools in the Puget Sound region who say, we want this to be taught statewide. And you could have 50 districts from the more rural parts of the state say, we don't want it. And you say, well, 50-2, that'll be an easy decision. You're right. Puget Sound gets whatever it wants.
Yes. And that is what they've been doing since 1986, and it has changed now in 2023. So we'll see. Maybe this will change that organization. It's extremely encouraging to people like us that want children to be treated kindly and with respect and not have secrets held away from their parents.
I guess the other thing I always wish these government organizations, which we pay the cost of, I mean, you serve on a school board. I know it's a thankless job. You don't get a salary in most cases. And then you have these associations and their get-togethers and all that. I wish what they do is more of the lessons learned. Hey, you want to teach math? This works really well. Well, where? In Enumclaw or in Ellensburg or some other place. And you say, well, this works really well. Okay, then maybe we should try that in the bigger districts as well. I see very little of that lessons learned stuff, even though it seems to work in just about every other part of life. If you say, I want to know how to do this, okay, let's find somebody who does it really well, and we'll learn from them instead of just, you know, Seattle and Tacoma cutting their own path. That's Leave Finnup. She's the director of the Center for Education at Washington Policy. In a moment, I'll get to your phone calls and emails. I promise to do that. I would argue that student cell phones in failing government schools are more necessary than ever and should not be banned. We'll get to that in just a moment. You've got the Radio Northwest now.
In the night, they stole them votes. Like a thief in the night, they stole them votes. 2,000 mules on a mission. 2,000 mules on a mission, rigging elections.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. At the risk of getting a bunch of naysayers, although we do love naysayers, I'm going to argue that student cell phones in failing government schools are more necessary than ever. And the thing that kind of prompted me to do this was an argument made in a publication I ordinarily like called The Federalist, in which they point out France banned all cell phones from public schools about 5 years ago. Italy did it the next year. Finland did it again. England did it this week. And then the question they pose is, American parents and teachers should be asking themselves this: how long will it take for American school districts and states to ban mobile phones, as the Europeans like to call them, in classrooms here as well? I hope they never do it. And if they do it, I'm going to encourage civil disobedience by parents and by students. I think that cell phones and the cameras that come with them and the recording capability that comes with them are absolutely essential, especially in today's increasingly dangerous and increasingly failing public schools. Let me get into the depths of that and drill down a little bit. But first, welcome to the program. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com and vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find a brand new question each and every day. We write it from the news of the day. Sometimes I do it. Sometimes my producers do it. We make it kind of a group effort to put together a great question for it. You can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or X if you prefer, or you can find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Now, you might wonder, I'm a big fan of education. I want kids to get educated especially. I want the bare minimum for American kids to be a high school diploma or a GED if you decide to proceed with your life a little bit earlier. And you might wonder, well, why would I want a potential distraction in the classroom? And cell phones are nothing if they are not major league distractions. But here's the danger I'm seeing. And we first really wised up to it during the pandemic about 3 years ago when we saw teachers saying, well, you can't put cameras for remote learning into the classrooms. If you do that, parents will actually see what's happening in the classrooms. That's problem one. Those cell phone cameras, and they're still being used this way, and I encourage kids and their parents to support the idea that when your kid sees something going on in a classroom, the political indoctrination, the racial indoctrination, the sexual grooming that goes on in far too many public schools, I want you to encourage your kid to document what's going on. And that means recording the audio, recording the video if possible, record both if possible, and then take those recordings and call these people out. And by these people, I mean the teachers. The teachers whose job it is, and it's a worthy job, to educate kids. But some of them have decided to use it as their own personal political playground, where they can just say, well, I want the kids to believe this about values, about sexuality, about race. And in some cases, it's being pushed by the administration of the school. Let's tell kids that if you have white skin, you're an oppressor. And if you have brown or black skin, that you're a perpetual victim. That kind of nonsense has got to stop. And I've found that I think the only way to get it stopped is expose it to public view. That's why that teacher that I still remember, it was happened to be a teacher in Philadelphia, but she was caught on camera saying, we can't let parents see what is going on in these classrooms. If we do, they're going to object and we're going to be in trouble. And she was absolutely right about that. They would be caught out. They would be in trouble. And that's what should be caught. But there's a second concern as well. And that has to do with the physical safety and security of students. Now, last week and this week, I've been highlighting something that happened in my backyard, and that is a young lady, 14 years old, a girl, walking down the hallway of her middle school. She's not even a high school age kid, physically attacked and beaten by another student. Student turned out to be transgender, so the student gets special treatment, and the schools try to sweep that under the rug just as fast as they possibly can. That's wrong. There are crimes happening in schools that the school administration has conspired to hide from the public, to hide from the authorities, to not summon the police. When there's a physical assault on a child, there is no excuse for not reporting. You know, I kind of thought I'd get a naysayer. Let's see what John's got to say. Hey, John, you're a naysayer. You disagree with me on this. Have at it. Tell us why.
I do. My wife is a high school teacher, special ed in math, and phones are a straight distraction in her classroom. The kids aren't using them for education. They're using them for entertainment. I hear what you're saying about recording, but in the state I live in, unless you have permission, you cannot record somebody.
That is technically true. That is technically true. Although, John, you and I have both seen a lot of recordings, including audio, including video, from all over the country. And one of the things that happens is I say to myself, yeah, they could probably get tagged. I have yet to see a prosecutor go after a student for having recorded audio and video, even in the states where it is technically illegal to do that. The prosecutors could. I think the reason they don't go after it is they realize the kid is calling out something that's more wrong. And that's what I would call, what lawyers call, the choice of evils defense. I mean, if you were in my car and you were bleeding to death, and I know the speed limit is 60, and I go 90 miles an hour to the hospital, and a cop, you know, after I've got you to the hospital, says, hey, you broke the law. I said, well, I had a choice of letting John bleed out or getting him to the hospital. It was a choice of evils, and I'd use that defense.
Lars, that's apples to oranges to what you're talking about. My wife, again, teaches math. There's nothing political about math. I hear what you're saying about some teachers. I would say that's a minority based on the teachers I know. So again,
I would agree that numerically it's a minority. But, John, I've seen math teachers and teachers teaching subjects that had nothing to do with sexuality, nothing to do with DEI, nothing to do with CRT, insert those things into their classrooms. Should they be called out?
I would say you could call them out without recording. Go to the administration.
No, you can't. John, well, you can't. Because okay, go ahead.
The school district my wife teaches in has a policy within the school district, phones are not allowed. But many teachers don't enforce that because they want to be the student's friend.
See, I get your point about the distraction. When it comes to a distraction, is one thing, but my point is that the reason I would encourage both kids and their parents to engage in civil disobedience and bust that rule is that when you see your teacher doing something wrong, and in some cases, some of this stuff gets right down to sexual grooming, where you've got teachers who, for whatever reason, whether it's their sexuality or not, are trying to tell kids, you can do things and not tell your parents. You can do sexual things and not tell your parents. You can do gender things and not tell your parents. That's wrong. Could we agree?
That is wrong. I think that's an exception. I think that happens less often than we want to think it does.
We
it
don't
does
know
happen.
Because the schools not cover it up.
Well, I
and our
I don't
crime
know about
our
that.
Crimes committed in your wife's school in physical assaults that are never reported to the police. Last answer. Quick.
Student on student, and my wife's life has been threatened by students.
The Lars Larson Show. Even from the back of his truck, Buddy Brown is preaching truth.
Because we're from the government and we're here to help.
Hey!
You lie to your face, act like you don't have a clue. We're living in D.C., we're called the Ministry of Truth.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. Glad to have you on board. And if you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Best conversation in talk journalism, and naysayers always go first at 866-439-5277. Now, I have not hidden the fact that I thoroughly approved of the removal of Kevin McCarthy as Speaker of the House of Representatives. I would like to see him replaced with a real conservative. I know people have toyed with the idea, and we've even done in the Twitter poll, Donald Trump could theoretically become the Speaker of the House. Trump's having fun with the idea. I don't think he's serious about it. He knows it would distract from his campaign for president. But would I like to see Steve Scalise in that job? Absolutely. So I thought I'd get somebody smarter than me on, Sarah Bedford, who's a political and investigative reporter for the Washington Examiner, talk about how this is actually going to go over, it sounds like, about the next week or so. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So tell me this. Are they going to be able to get Republicans together in a room, kind of like herding cats, and get a consensus on a new Speaker of the House?
Well, you know, it was so easy the first time in January that I'm sure it's going to be a cakewalk this time. You know, I think it's difficult because you have such a small, slim margin here for Republicans. Any candidate, Scalise or Jordan, is going to have a tough time uniting everybody. When McCarthy was, you know, potentially even more of a consensus candidate, in January, and he had to go through more than a dozen rounds of voting to unite everyone, even though he was running unopposed. Now you have two really credible, really popular candidates running against each other, and I think the path for either of them is going to be even more difficult than McCarthy's was in January.
Now, you're talking about Jim Jordan and you're talking about Steve Scalise?
Yes, those are the two right now. With the most serious candidacy.
You mean Jeffries doesn't have a prayer of becoming Speaker of the House? Hakeem?
No, I'm pretty sure after Democrats didn't lift a finger to save the Republican leader, there will be no Republicans looking to help Democrats out.
No, and they didn't help out. But, you know, I guess in some ways, if we had a bigger majority, all we'd be saying is, well, we're going to elect a new speaker, and he won't be the choice of, say, 20 members, but he is the choice of enough to get him past the margin, and that's if you had a bigger margin. That's all we'd be saying is that they would ignore a certain faction of Republican lawmakers. In some ways, as a conservative, I side with the Freedom Caucus. If they say we're going to block McCarthy like they did in January, and then they can't get enough votes to get somebody other than McCarthy, he can't get enough votes to become Speaker unless he makes promises, and then he made promises, and I don't always agree with Matt Gaetz from Florida, but I believe he's right that Kevin McCarthy made the promises and that didn't fulfill them.
Well, you know, you're never going to be able to please everyone in a conference, right? And so,
right.
You know, to play devil's advocate to that, I mean, this is a pretty dramatic, historic thing that happened. Kevin McCarthy didn't, you know, murder anyone. He wasn't indicted. I mean, this is over a philosophical disagreement about an annual spending bill, which
right.
At the end of the day, is that disagreement, does it rise to the level of taking as drastic a step as Matt Gaetz did? I think that's the complaint among some Republicans is, sure, maybe McCarthy didn't to the letter hold up everything that he said he hoped to do with the appropriations bills, but does that rise to the level of needing a motion to vacate? I think a lot of Republicans would say this has been a sort of self-defeating amount of chaos. But what's done is done. McCarthy is not Speaker anymore, right?
Right.
And, you know, I'm hearing a lot of optimism, actually, about the Jim Jordan candidacy as someone who can win over those eight holdouts, the handful of people who voted against McCarthy, who may be skeptical of a McCarthy acolyte, McCarthy's number two, just taking one step up the ladder.
Yeah, because that worked out so well when Paul Ryan went off the stage and his second in command, his number two, stepped up, right?
Right. I mean, I think, you know, there's a trust issue there. If you, like you mentioned, there are conservatives who feel that they were betrayed by McCarthy. And so Scalise's challenge would be to convince those conservatives that he'll operate differently, even though he's operated hand in glove with McCarthy for all these years. Now that he's got the top job, is he going to be something totally different? That's, you know, an open question. He could very well be, but that's the thing that he has to persuade the holdouts. Jordan's challenge is kind of opposite, right? He has to go to moderates who would be skeptical of someone so closely associated with the Freedom Caucus and with the further right part of the House Republican Conference and convince them that he can unite the whole party and not just be a Freedom Caucus champion. So they really have opposite challenges when it comes to uniting the conference for their speakership candidacies.
I'm talking to Sarah Bedford, a political and investigative reporter of the Washington Examiner. The reason I thought the continuing resolution was such a big deal. And I know people say, well, what's the big deal? Not an annual budget, but we'll kick the can down the road 45 days to just before Thanksgiving. Then we'll probably kick it again in December and kick it again. I mean, isn't that how we got into this mess to begin with, when regular budgets gave up about 20 years ago? And they said, well, we'll just kind of limp the whole government along, and that'll give certain people the ability to add in little things they wanted to get. They tried to get some more Ukraine money in the continuing resolution. That got blocked, thank God. But we were told, well, there's kind of a secret deal between Kevin McCarthy and Joe Biden. No, we got to have a budget for the country. And Republicans should be able to say, if Border Patrol isn't doing its job, we're going to cut its funding. And we're going to do that in the annual budget, instead of all this little piecemeal stuff that I think was what got us to the terrible situation we're in today.
I think, yeah, there's a ton of frustration with that process. You're absolutely right. But like you mentioned, it has been going on for, 20 years. It's been a long time since regular order appropriations bills have passed. They've been doing it by omnibus. They've been doing it by continuing resolution for a long time. That's not a new failure that falls squarely at the feet of McCarthy. So I think there's a lot of Republicans who would say this was, this didn't make the appropriations process any easier. The next speaker is going to have arguably an even more difficult time getting something over the finish line when they're dealing with this much chaos. The next speaker is going to have to make a lot of promises to a lot of different parts of the Republican Party at a time when they're also trying to position themselves to move the spending bills through. That's just a really, really complicated situation that could hamstring the budget process even further. I've seen some discussion just among the chattering class, the pundits, about whether it would be smart to leave McHenry in charge of the conference until the appropriations process is over. Let him take all the slings and arrows from the far right, from the moderates, and then have the new speaker come in with a clean slate. That makes sense on paper, but the next speaker is, realistically going to have to deal with the spending fight, and it's going to be messy for them.
Well, I got to tell you, Sarah, he does have the coolest name, Patrick McHenry, of any House speaker I've ever heard of, and that's number one. Number two, I love the fact that he saw the opportunity and said, you know what? Nancy Pelosi loses her little special secret office outside the House chambers. I kind of like that, too. It's small potatoes, but you know what? If you said, if I ever become speaker, Nancy's losing her secret clubhouse.
That's right. I mean, does anyone think for one second that if the shoe was on the other foot, Democrats would not have booted a Republican out of that office the minute they took power, and McCarthy was sort of gracious enough to let her keep that for 9 months? So, I think Republicans may be wisening up to start treating Democrats like Democrats would like to treat them.
You bet.
But, I think it's more symbolic than anything.
You can read what she writes at the Washington Examiner. She is political and investigative reporter Sarah Bedford. Sarah, thanks so much for the time. Back in a moment. I'll get to your call. 866-HEY-LARS. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
Daily, and so does Denzel.
If you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed. If you do read it, you're misinformed.
And
tell the truth, not just to be first, but to tell the truth.
Oh, and this one.
Anything you practice, you'll get good at, including BS.
More truth now. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Just give me some truth.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show is brought to you by the home power generating folks at ProTech Power. Make sure your loved ones are safe when the power goes out. Call 541-ONA-GEN. That's 541-ONA-GEN. To your calls now. Let's start with Alan. Hey, Alan, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Oh, hi, Lars. I just want to talk about the cost of the Ukrainian war. Beyond the 500,000 casualties, many of which are 18 or 19, Rand Paul did a really good job of breaking down the actual numbers. He took the $113 billion that's been allocated, and he put that on a daily basis. And that daily number was $233 million.
Unbelievable.
And you think about what we could do with that.
A day.
Yeah, in a per day. And so I think when people understand that, and you think about, you talked about schools, you know, with about $70 million to build a rural school, we could build three schools a day. You talk about the homeless. In a couple of weeks, we could probably house most of the homeless in the United States. So I wanted to...
Not a good idea, but we could, yeah.
Yeah, but again, $233 million. We get so caught up that when we're hearing about trillion-dollar deficits, the T number, and then and billion-dollar here, we forget that $1 billion is $1,000 million.
Yeah, well, how about this, Alan, the way I've always thought was a better way to tell this to people is you say if the government spends just a single billion, and I'm not sure the federal government even spends a single billion on anything. There's nothing that small anymore. But that's $3 from every man, woman, and child in America. And not everybody pays taxes, so the load falls more heavily than $3 a person. But if it was spread out evenly among all our citizens, it'd be $3 a piece. You say, so a family of four, that's $12. If it's $1 trillion, that's $3,000 per family member. So when the government goes out and runs a $1 trillion deficit, they spend $1 trillion more than they took in. So they're effectively putting it on the big national credit card. It's adding $12,000 for every family of four in America. And you have to ask yourself, hold on, you just added $12,000 to the Visa card that my family owns or is responsible for? And you go, yep, $12,000 this year. And next year, we're going to do a $2 trillion deficit. We're going to add $24,000 for every family of four in America. Now, that at least makes it most people could wrap their head around, the government went out and spent $24,000 on our behalf as a family of four more than they took in. Why, that would be enough to buy a really decent used car. It would be enough to put a down payment on a house in most of America. I mean, when you bring it down to an individual basis or a daily basis or an individual person basis, it makes that number a whole lot more understandable. Let's go to Adam. Hey, Adam, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I disagree with you when it comes to the cell phone issue with the kids. And in one respect, just one respect.
Okay.
We know what these people are doing with our children. We know what they're doing day to day. And it shouldn't be our children's responsibility to deviate from the three R's and report on the deviant behavior of their.
Who else is going to do it?
I don't have a solution, my friend. The distraction bothers me.
Okay, but Adam, hold on. When I opened up that topic, I made it a point to say, as far as the distraction is going, control that. If the kid is sitting there playing video games or watching a movie or doing things like that, I understand that. But if the child is videotaping a teacher doing something that is wrong, and you realize it's wrong when you watch it, and I've seen literally hundreds of these videos of teachers engaging in
arrested in Ohio.
Yeah, and all I'm saying is, Adam, that when a student sees this, that incident that I've talked about that happened at Tiger Twalton schools that they are doing everything they can to cover up right now, if I just come on the air and said, well, I'm told by a student that one student physically attacked the other student in the hallway. Well, what happened? Well, she got knocked down. You say, well, that doesn't sound too bad. Well, hold on. Did she go to the hospital? What?
There's cameras all over the schools.
Yeah, but you're not going to get access to any of that video from the school administration because they're going to tell you why we can't invade student privacy. So there's a physical attack on a student. That's a crime in every community in America, Adam. And you say, well, how bad was it? A girl got knocked down and she got right up and she didn't go to the hospital, but she seemed a little bit upset. If you just describe it with words, doesn't sound like much. When you see the vicious attack that the one student, the transgender, imposed on the other student, you say, hold on, that's crazy. That's outrageous. We all know of situations where when we see it with our own eyes, if possible, or on video, it looks a whole lot different than even somebody describing it with 10,000 words, doesn't it?
It does, but I think it's a major distraction from what school is for.
Well, except for this. Like I said, if you're playing video games, if you're swapping text messages with your friends, that's one thing. But if something is done like a physical attack on another student or a teacher who's trying to push crazy indoctrination on sex, on race, on politics, or anything else, I think that's not a distraction. It's absolutely essential that we know about it. The schools are not going to tell you about it voluntarily. And as we're seeing already in the case of the transgender attack on the 14-year-old girl, they're trying to cover this one up and bury it just as fast as they can, despite the fact that video is available. The Lars